Welcome to Northtown News on FM 105.3, AM 1440, and WEBRradio.com. And now, here's your host, Art Pappas.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Northtown News. I'm your host, Art Pappas, right here at WEBR 1440 AM and FM 105.3 and WEBRradio.com. And my guests will enlighten you on a particular topic about history, education, or events happening in the communities, mainly north of Buffalo. Not always, but most of the time. I want to welcome my first guest for part one of the show, and I'm going to do that immediately. And I'm honored to have with me tonight my special guest, Dr. Jeffrey Smalden, retired forensic psychologist and author of the book, The Beast Is Not Me. Wow. The wow isn't part of the title, but that title intrigued me. We'll talk about that in a couple minutes.
Okay.
You've had a long 25-year career as a forensic psychologist and wrote this book about notorious killers like Manson, Bundy, Gacy, and others. In what ways is your book unique and different from others who have written about the psychology of serial killers?
I'm glad that you asked me that question.
Are you really?
Because I am. I am. I actually address it in the author's note at the beginning of the book. I say specifically that it was never my intent to don the mantle of expert and offer readers yet another journey inside the mind of the serial killer. As I put it in my note, in my view, that trip has become something of a tourist trap with too many self-proclaimed experts and not enough new sights to see. Instead of doing that, I wanted to write a book of stories about my personal experiences. And there's a lot in there about the psychology of serial murderers, but mainly I wanted to be a storyteller. I wanted to bring readers along with me as I recounted the unusually large number of uncommon experiences I've accumulated over five decades involving murder and murderers.
That's kind of interesting. That's a kind of a unique approach.
I meant it to be. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to write another book about the psychology of the serial killer. Mm-hmm. Though I hope readers will come away from my book with some new insights, or at least some new examples of how serial killers think, perceive their victims, perceive their choices in life, and so on.
You're a native of North Tonawanda.
I am. I'm not originally from North Tonawanda. My dad was in the FBI. I always refer to him as a Hoover-era G-man because that's what he was. And back in when I was young and growing up, FBI agents would get transferred every year or two. So by the time I moved to North Tonawanda at the beginning of my fourth grade year, I think we had moved eight different places. But North Tonawanda is where we settled. My dad was in charge of the FBI office in resident agency, they called it in Niagara Falls, for many years. And even though I haven't lived in North Tonawanda full time for 50 years, I've never stopped referring to it as my hometown.
Well, I know I saw your yearbook picture in the North Tonawanda yearbook.
Yeah, it's my hometown. I mean, last night I gave a talk at the NT Library and saw many old friends who I've known for over 50 years, and it was fantastic.
At an early age, you showed an interest in assassinations and conspiracy theories. What was that like for you so young?
Well, I wouldn't say so much conspiracy theories, but I cite as one example in my book, my dad was assigned to FBI headquarters during my third grade year, and we took a family trip to Ford's Theater. And while most kids my age, I was eight, would have come away from that experience with a newly invigorated interest in the Civil War or Abraham Lincoln, I was all about the assassination plot. I was fascinated by it. My parents bought me a souvenir pamphlet called The Crime at Ford's Theater, which I still have. And I was just fascinated. I learned the backgrounds of all of the people and how they were involved, what their role in the conspiracy was. And when I look back on that, the reason I cite that in my book is I see it as one early indicator of what would become a lifelong interest on my part in outsiders, outcasts, and eventually criminals.
You know, we mentioned Ford's Theater. Probably most children that age that you were talking about, 8 years old, they probably would look around the theater and it would be kind of interesting. They've been there, whatever. But you took a little further. You got right into not just the interest in Abraham Lincoln and as president. He was at Ford's Theater as associate. But you went right into the information behind this assassination and looked for a young fella. You were delving pretty deep.
I was a very curious kid. Not necessarily the smartest kid on the block, but very curious. And for whatever reason, that case was one of the first things that really triggered my curiosity and made me want to know as much about it as I could.
As your life progressed, from what I found out, a little bit of reading, you developed a preoccupation with outlaws and outsiders. Why do you think so?
Well, I've asked myself that question, and the best answer that I've come up with, because I've never really been like an outlaw type myself. I've kind of been a rule follower most of my life. And in most ways, most fundamental ways.
Sure.
But we moved a lot when I was a kid. So I had the experience of being an outsider a lot of the time and not feeling like I fit in and trying to struggle to, you know, for some accommodation in the social world that is so difficult to navigate for most kids. And I look back and I think, well, that's maybe where the kind of germ of this interest in the outsider first was located.
You said something about you moved several times by the time you were 8 years old?
Many times.
Many
times. I think 8 times.
All right. So if you moved 8 times in 8 years...
it was a lot.
That is a lot for a child. But that does, I think, have a strong... indication of why you had the interest on outside things too. It's a broader perspective.
And I used to say, and I think this is poignant still to me, when people would ask me, what are some of your most vivid early memories of growing up? I would say waving goodbye to my friends. So, you know, I had that experience over and over again of making friends and waving goodbye to them, leaving and starting somewhere else.
It's almost like a military family that
very much like a military family. I mean, I've often said that. It's not like I think my experience was unique, because I know a lot of so-called military brats also moved a lot as kids. For whatever reason, it seems to have had that effect on me, to have triggered a lifelong interest in outsider types.
And I think there's a lot to that. Because I know as a former teacher, when I would get students in my class that traveled around a lot or had moved several times, they did have a different perspective or a different outlook on things that people that grew up in one place forever.
Yeah.
The thinking is a little bit different, and it definitely is broader.
What was different for me, anyway?
As a college student, you corresponded with Charles Manson and his family members. That's something right there. How did that relationship change you? Tell us about that.
Well, this is where the North Tonawanda-centric part of my history comes in. I wasn't in North Tonawanda when that correspondence began. I was an undergraduate student at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And my senior year, I was taking a course in abnormal psychology, and my professor mentioned in class one day that he had read Helter Skelter. It had come out in 1974 about the Manson case, And I had paid almost no attention to the Manson case when it occurred in August of 1969. I was all about sports and my social life at NT High School.
Sure.
Didn't pay much attention. But I read Helter Skelter, and he did as well. So I stayed after class one day to talk with him, and I said, you know, it's funny when you read that book, a lot of those young people who fell in around Manson, looked up to him as kind of a godlike figure, were from middle-class families, not unlike my own. I can't understand how that happened. And sometimes in the media depictions of them, you would get the impression that they had somehow lost all ability to function autonomously, that Manson was controlling everything they did. And I said, I can't quite figure that out. I wonder if some of them are a little more complicated than that. And he said, yeah, well, have you ever thought about writing them? And I said, no. Writing members of the Manson family? No. The thought had never, ever crossed my mind. But I ended up doing it. And it actually exerted quite a bit of effort to do it. Manson was easy enough to locate in Folsom Prison. But some of his followers I wanted to write to, like Squeaky Fromey, who would develop her own brand of infamy in September of 1975 when she attempted to assassinate President Ford. She wasn't in prison. She wasn't in prison at the time. I didn't know where she was. I just knew she wasn't in prison, and she was still a devoted follower of Manson. So I managed to contact her and her roommate, fellow Manson devotee Sandra Good, and some other members of the Manson family. And in the summer of 1975, my first letters with Manson and Squeaky Fromey were exchanged in March of 1975. Then I graduated that spring, and I was going to begin graduate school at Purdue in the fall. But I came back to North Tonawanda for the summer, lived with my parents in Wurlitzer Park, and I was a substitute mail carrier at the post office. And letters were coming in addressed to my parents' address on Sun Valley Drive from Charles Manson, Lynette Squeaky Fromey. My dad's an FBI agent. And so I would, I would intercept these letters at the post office in the morning. I would, the post deliverer who carried to my parents' house was a friend of mine. And I mean, they were funny mornings. I would be on the other side of the post office sorting mail, and I would hear, "Smalden, you got a hot one over here." And that was a signal that there was a letter from a member of the Manson family that had come in that morning. And so he would give it to me, and I would review it. And then at the end of the day, I would usually recite the contents to my poor mother while she was trying to prepare her dinner. I would wait for my dad to get home and give him the condensed summary later on.
You know, you mentioned something. You hit a point there that just struck something with me about how somebody like Manson or whatever, they somehow would command the people around them to follow them or to listen to them. And, you know, I remember even in high school and college, and there seemed to be someone there all the time, another student of some kind, which that person, whatever they said, a lot of students were always listening, and they would follow that student.
Interesting.
You know, and it kind of rung a bell with me,
I mean, Manson's an interesting case study in a lot of ways, obviously, but he was a lifelong criminal. He'd spent, and he came from a horribly dysfunctional early childhood, so he was shuttled around from foster home to relatives to reformatories. And always said, you know, I never really had parents. He never knew his father. His mother was a teenage prostitute, criminal. And Manson learned a lot. He became very savvy. And by the time he was in his 20s and 30s, he was studying like Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie in prison. And, you know, these techniques of persuasion. And he learned pretty well. I mean, he learned a lot of ways to break down young people's ties to their family. And there was a unique confluence of events when he was freed from prison in early 1967. He didn't really know what was happening in society, but that was the summer of love, where all of these young people were flooding to San Francisco looking for a guru, looking for a way. And Manson came out of prison and was like, wow, have I landed in paradise here? That all he found his persuasive skills worked well. And there were people ripe for his brand of persuasion.
You started to refer to your father a little bit ago, and he was a lifelong FBI agent. And you corresponded with that squeaky Fromm that you mentioned before the assassination attempt on President Ford. Did your dad try to influence you at that time?
He didn't. During that summer, he was remarkably tolerant when I look back. I think he thought I was crazy, but he knew... He knew I wasn't going to flee to the West Coast and join the Manson family. He knew that it was an academic interest, and I think he thought it was reckless and kind of crazy, but he never told me I had to stop. And I remember, I mean, this is a funny story. I had already gone to Purdue and begun, I was like first week of graduate school in the fall of 1975, September, and my dad calls me one day and he said, Jeff, I got a call in from my boss in the Buffalo office. He was working out of Buffalo then. And he said, Jack, I hate to tell you this, but the FBI in Sacramento say that when they searched Squeaky Fromm's apartment, this was like within a week of the assassination, they found a cache of letters from someone named Jeff who has your last name and your address. Like somehow this would be a surprise to my dad. And my dad said, yeah. I know about that. That would be my wayward son, Jeff. Let me explain. And he did. The FBI in Sacramento was concerned for my safety because Squeaky Fromm's roommate, Sandy Good, who just months before then had written me letters about people getting their arms chopped off, their heads chopped off, very apocalyptic, threatening letters. And they were afraid she was going to try to contact me, which she didn't, at least before she got sent to prison for sending threatening letters in the mail.
For anyone that may have tuned in late, we're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Smaldon, a retired forensic psychologist and author of the book, The Beast Is Not Me. Dr. Smaldon, when you were an administrator at the hospital in Ohio, two co-workers were murdered, and the case is still unsolved. Why did that event make you leave the hospital and seek a degree in forensic psychology?
Well, I begin my book with a chapter about the hospital murders, and the reason I chose to do that, even though it gets things out of chronological order a little bit, is that that changed my entire life. That event changed everything that's occurred since then. I had kind of left the Manson chapter behind. I'm still interested in it, but I had moved on. And I'd studied a year at Trinity College in Ireland, still studying literature. I thought I was going to become an English professor. And then I decided I didn't really want to do that. I didn't think that would be a good niche for me. And so for kind of random reasons, I ended up getting a master's in hospital administration and being assigned to what was then the largest private general hospital in Ohio. And in December of 1983, two of my coworkers in a small research lab that I had administrative responsibility for were savagely murdered between 4:30 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday, both stabbed close to 30 times. There was only one door leading in and out of this research lab, which was right off the main corridor of the hospital. It was bizarre. No one saw anybody enter the lab or leave the lab. The police didn't make any arrests. And for me, going to work after that became very stressful. And I finally decided, well, I was never cut out to be a businessman anyway. I'm going to go back and do my PhD and become a forensic psychologist.
Wow. You were in contact with Gacy while on death row Harvey while in prison and consulting with Dillian.
Correct.
Did you ever feel fear while dealing with violent killers?
Not as much fear as I probably should have, particularly in the case of John Wayne Gacy. I spent close to 20 hours with Gacy on death row in Illinois, and his legs were shackled, and he had handcuffs on. But there were no guards anywhere to be seen. We were alone on the death row visiting area. At one point, I needed to summon a guard to get me to a restroom, and I ended up having to scream as loud as I could to get the guard's attention. That's how isolated Gacy and I were. And Gacy would invite me over to his side of the table to look through his photo albums. And I was wary, but not frightened. But Gacy could have easily put his handcuffs around my neck and squeezed, and nobody would have been there to help me. In fact, when I got there, the guard said, "I hope nothing goes awry while you're with Mr. Gacy, but you know why he's on death row. And should anything go awry, or God forbid, should a hostage situation develop, I just want you to know you'll be on your own because we don't negotiate with inmates. Do you understand?" I said, Yeah, I guess. I'd driven 450 miles to get there. I wasn't going to go turn around and go home. But it was, an unsettling experience.
Boy, I don't even know what to say next with some of what you're what you're saying here. But you've consulted on 300 death penalty cases and worked on 1,000 murder cases. Has this experience allowed you to capture the mind games of monsters?
I'm glad you used the phrase mind games, because one of the things I say frequently when I'm asked to talk about serial killers is that most of them are pretty intelligent. Most of them are above average intelligence, and they love to play games. They like hiding in plain sight. That's part of the thrill for them. Sometimes they get caught because they get so brazen and ratchet up the level of risk so much that they make a mistake. Like, that's what happened with Gacy. Do I have time to tell a short Bundy-related anecdote?
Our time is getting short, but we'll come back to this because I want to get to this next question I have, and I've had this in mind since I heard about you, is why did you title your book "The Beast Is Not Me"?
Well, a small correction, Art. It's actually "That Beast Was Not Me."
Okay.
And it's a direct quote from the first proper letter Charles Manson ever wrote me. And what he said early in that letter was, "Take all you've ever heard about me and the Manson family and think about it as backwards. Our side of the family was never told. That beast was not me, but it's what everyone needs me to be, so they make me up to be a reflection of their fears and lies. They need me to be this epic boogeyman, and that's not who I am." So that's one of the reasons I chose "That Beast Was Not Me," because a lot of these killers very strenuously resist the efforts by other people to define who they are, how they function psychologically, why they do what they do. One other reason I chose that title is it sounds like I'm kind of drawing a line between myself and these people I'm writing about. That beast was not me. It's somebody else. But I meant to be pointing to the difficulties that always arise when we try to draw bold lines between those people and the rest of us. We might not be, you know, we might not be mass murderers in the making or serial killers, but like, there's a huge population of people in this country who are very, very interested in those people and they collect serial killer artifacts and memorabilia. So sometimes the line of demarcation isn't quite as clear as you might imagine.
The book, from what I understand, is entertaining. It's instructive. It's full of candor. Where can it be obtained?
Well, it can be obtained on Amazon. It can be obtained through Barnes & Noble. And it can also be obtained directly from the publisher, Black Lion Publishing in Oregon. Those are the places where it's most readily available right now.
Okay. And you wanted to refer to something.
I'll make it short, but I think it's a classic.
Okay.
I wrote Ted Bundy a letter in 1984. He's cooling his heels on death row in Florida after a spasm of violence there. And I wrote him a letter in 1984, a year after the hospital murders, thinking, well, Ted Bundy might have some information that would help me understand the kind of person who could have killed my coworkers. And he didn't respond. And I thought, okay, well, that's the end of that. I'm not interested in bothering him, so I wasn't going to write him back. And then a year later, he writes me back, get two envelopes in the mail on the same day with Ted Bundy's return address. One is a Christmas card wishing me and mine health and all blessings in the upcoming year. And then the letter, where it's a short letter, he says, Dear Jeff, sorry it's taken me such an inordinately long time to respond. You wrote me over a year ago. I recently found your letter amongst my papers, sounding like a professor. And he says, all I can say in response to the questions you asked is that they were very thoughtful and searching. I want you to know I've never felt better in my life, physically, spiritually, and emotionally. I hope the same can be said for you. And then here's the game. This is a guy whose calling card was the incredible distances he would travel in search of his victims. The FBI referred to him as a rover, killed women in Oregon, Utah, Colorado, Washington, Florida. He was very, very mobile. He ends his letter, take care, watch yourself, travel light, peace, Ted.
Oh, okay. That's kind of chilling.
That's why I wanted to tell it. Yeah, I think it's just sort of a classic. He thought he was being clever, and he knew I would get the joke. But yeah, that's the serial killer's tease.
Boy, I don't know how to even respond to that.
And I'm not sure.
But I do have to say our time is up. I have to thank you for being with us here on Northtown News. And I think we're going to have to get a copy of this book. It sounds like it's very intriguing and interesting and chilling, exciting, newsworthy.
I hope it's all those things.
All of the things, all these adjectives.
I hope you'll check it out, and I appreciate you inviting me to be your guest, Art. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And we will be back after a short break.
Thanks for listening to Northtown News. To be a sponsor of our show, call Jackie at 716-553-4679. Now, once again, here's Art Pappas.
Okay, and here we are back with part two of our program, Northtown News. And we're here at WEBR AM 1440, FM 105.3, and WEBRradio.com. And my guest for part two of the program is Mr. Phil Banks, founder and treasurer of the Niagara Celtic Heritage Society Board in Burke, New York. So we're really hitting north of the Niagara County, aren't we?
Yes, and I'm glad to be here, and I'm actually excited about a radio station that will cover some of the areas up north of the city that a lot of people, if you're from the city, don't even know it exists up here, you know, so it's exciting to have some coverage for a lot of the activity in eastern Niagara County.
Yeah, that's one of the missions of this particular Northtown News. We try to do as much as we can north of Buffalo and as much as Niagara County as we can. But we do a little bit of Erie County and the Buffalo area, but mostly Northtown. So anyway, we're glad to have you here. And I'll just start out by mentioning the Society will soon be hosting a festival at the Niagara County Fairgrounds right here in September coming up, correct?
Yep, 2 weeks. 2 weeks after Labor Day every year. Mm-hmm. Every year since 2001, with the exception of COVID in 2020.
Oh, that COVID did it,
didn't it? Got everybody. And I'll tell you what kind of surprised us is that I call it the COVID hangover. it was still in effect last year. Our attendance had remained flat after COVID, and we're kind of excited that this might be the year we get back to pre-COVID levels, but only time will tell.
Right. It's been tough with everybody and everything, every organization.
And I think to a degree, because our demographic tends to be, the average attendee at our event tends to be somewhat older, has more time, has a little bit more money, mm-hmm. but that was also the demographic that might have been hit the hardest by COVID, and or they've been cautious about coming back out
sure,
again.
Sure, sure.
So it had kind of a double whammy on us, but we're looking forward to this year. Real positive feedback so far. Pre-sale tickets are up strong, so we got mm-hmm. our fingers and toes crossed for
okay.
this one.
Well, let's begin where you got the inspiration to create this festival for the society.
Well, you know, we actually did it the reverse. We had the idea of developing a festival and having – my wife and I are both from the town of Newfane. She grew up in Burt. Mm-hmm. I grew up at Alcott Beach. And Alcott Beach, as you may know, most people know, has been a tourist haven 100, 125 years. So it's always had the tradition of having rather large events. And it was kind of at a slow point, and some of us were just kind of thinking, hey, maybe we could put together another event down here. We saw, what's interesting is we had read an article in the Reader's Digest, and probably in 2000, that talked about a small town in Texas that was looking for a little bit of economic development activity, and they started a bluegrass festival that had, over the years, grown to be quite successful. So that was kind of the germ of the idea, and then we had traveled. My wife and I traveled extensively in Ontario. I actually worked there early in my career, and then we had a lot of friends up there, and we had been to Celtic events in Ontario that coincidentally were on the Great Lakes, on Georgian Bay, Lake Huron, etc. And it just sort of began to, our vision became together that, hey, we could maybe do this in Alcott Beach. Hmm. And we knew from experience that there was a fair number of Irish and Scottish people with ancestry in Western New York State. Mm-hmm. And we did the numbers. It was hundreds of thousands, as you can imagine,
sure.
between the Scottish and the Irish. And, of course, there have been Irish festivals that have come and gone. There was an extensive Scottish festival at the Amherst Museum. There was a huge Celtic event in Fort Erie back in the day. So we knew the potential was here, and so we said, why not? I was fortunate enough to retire somewhat early. It became kind of a give-back project. So we got this thing rolling, and then in time found out that it would behoove us probably to be a not-for-profit. When we started it, we were just, hey, let's do this. We discovered, you know, probably beneficial to be a not-for-profit, which then required some kind of an organization. So we then formed the society that eventually got full not-for-profit status from New York State in 2007, and then we got 501c3 not-for-profit status from the IRS in 2010. So we're all legit, and we're very happy we switched to a not-for-profit because mm-hmm. that's what saved us during COVID. We were able to get a lot of financing.
A non-profit organization, and you said it was established when?
Well, the original, just the group that started this thing back in the day would have been 2001, but the official, you know, New York State education, not-for-profit educational corp status was May of 2007, mm-hmm. and then December of 2010, we finally received IRS 501c3 status. So we've been the full-blown not-for-profit with all of the stamps and approvals since 2010, so we're 14 years into
it. What would you say the mission of the society is?
It's real straightforward. We, in this little corner of the world, we call Western and Central New York, and I've lately heard the term Greater Western New York. We're trying to maintain the heritage of the seven Celtic nations, and some people in this area, people are quite familiar with Ireland and Scotland, mm-hmm. but there's five other areas in the British Isles and France and Spain that have descendants that were standalone Celtic countries at one point. In fact, even had their own languages and everything. So we have Cornwall, we have Wales, we have the Isle of Man, known as Manx language. We have Brittany on the coast of France. And then there's a province called Galicia in Spain, all of which have descendants that live in the States, although the last five I mentioned don't have a lot of population in this area, but they will drive hundreds of miles to come to an event like this. So that's our mission, to keep all of the activities alive that we'll talk about.
It sounds fantastic from the little bit I've read about it. To fulfill your mission, you hold this festival each September, correct?
Every the 2 weeks after Labor Day weekend.
Uh-huh. And where does the revenue come from to host this event?
The majority actually is ticket sales, vendor income. We do get some, with the exception of COVID, when the federal government gave us some assistance. We do get a little bit of sponsorship. We get some grant money, but it's relatively low. By definition, we're kind of a small not-for-profit. So we've got our hand out all the time, but it doesn't get much put in it very often. So to be sustainable, we really have to be self-sufficient on generating revenue. And a large percentage comes from income the weekend of the festival. It's very seasonal for us.
So it's every September, and this has been going on for how long?
Well, our first one, it's kind of an interesting coincidence. Our first one was in 2001, 3 weeks after 9/11. And the significance is, I don't know if you remember this, but you look like we're of an age. When 9/11 happened in 2001, all sorts of events were canceled for fear of another attack or for some reason. There was a lot. But we stuck it out. We said, you know what, damn it, we worked hard all this year to get ready to do this thing, and we went ahead and did it. And then I think that kind of gave us some fortitude for the COVID crisis. We'd been there once, and everybody agreed to just hang in. And again, with the help of the federal government, you know, we qualified for assistance, and we would not be here now if they hadn't taken care of us.
When you first began, you had something like 500 attendees at Crawl
Park. Yes, max. No, actually, we didn't. We were not at Crawl Park the first year.
Oh, you weren't?
The very first year, we were at a campground immediately to the west of Crawl Park, near the harbor. And it became evident we were going to outgrow that real fast. And we were happy to have 500 people. And you know what I tell a story is, we have 400 volunteers. That's how big this is. It takes us 400 volunteers to run it.
That's a lot
of
people.
That's damn near the same amount that attended our very first festival. So,
yeah. Well, and, of course, Crawl Park, we're talking about Olcott.
Oh, yeah, the jewel of the Niagara County Park System. And we were there right up through 2018. But again, we outgrew that space, and that space was 11 acres. That was the north side of the park, and of course the lake, et cetera. A lot of people are disappointed when we relocated away from the lake. But I also say that, you know, it's interesting. If you drew a circle around where our event was, half of the potential attendees were fish. In other words, when we moved south to the fairgrounds, it make it easier for people farther south to come up and see us. So,
wow, how many Scottish nations are involved, and how many representatives from various clans attend?
We're proud to say that we have the largest attendance of clans.
Okay,
the clans. So that within the Scottish ancestry, people know what clans are, and there's a few Irish clans, but not too many. They actually are the remnants of the clan from the Highlands of Scotland their ancestors essentially were chased out of Scotland all through the 1700s, and a lot of them wound up in Canada and the United States. And they've maintained the so-called clan lineage all this time. So we will have 35 different clans representing family lines from Scotland. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest gathering of the clans in New York State. We're the biggest now, partly because some of the other ones are gone due to COVID. But on the other hand, we've sustained, and we're proud to say we have the biggest gathering of Celtic culture anywhere in New York State. And frankly,
all that right there in Olcott.
Well, it was in Olcott. And now we're at the fairgrounds. We had relocated. Right. Okay. We were running into all sorts of space problems. You mentioned you ran out of space. We had 11 acres, and you go, how could you run out of space in 11 acres? Well, we have so much stuff going on that it was easier to do. We used to have the Highland Athletes, which, by the way, they're the type that the people
I was going to ask you, what are the Highland games played? And,
you know what? I'm going to cover that, but I want to tell you, we got so tight for space when we were in Olcott in our last year. The clan guys and the athletes were fighting over, not literally, but they would fight over space because there wasn't enough for everybody. So that's when we began to realize, you know, if this thing's going to go long term, we're going to have a bigger place. And that's when we relocated.
Okay.
Now, the Highland Games are
Before you get into the Highland Games, we're going to take a short break, okay, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back for part two of our program. So I interrupted you there for a short time, but we're speaking with Mr. Phil Banks, founder and treasurer of the Niagara Celtic Heritage Society Board, located in Burt, New York. So go ahead with the...
And I do want to correct you, because by chance, if my wife hears this... We're co-founders, and she reminds me of that pretty regularly.
Okay.
I'm not just founder.
Fair enough.
Yeah, let's got to keep things happy at home. She's actually director now. She runs the whole operation, retired teacher. So we were talking about the Highland Games. Those that are Scottish or have lived in Western New York for a while may have seen Highland Games because they're a lot more popular around here than people know. A lot of people know. But it's a very unique genre. So... we coincidentally have the biggest gathering of Highland athletes in terms of numbers of classes, numbers of groups and ages, et cetera, outside Scotland. So we will have 75 to 100 athletes compete over the weekend. What's unique, almost everybody knows about the so-called throwing the foam pole or the caber toss, as it's known. That's pretty common. But all of the other types of activity that are included... I've got the list right here. They throw a sheaf, essentially a bag of straw that they throw it as high as they can in a vertical. And we've got some guys who can throw it 35 feet in the air with a pitchfork, throw it in the air, and it has to go over the top. And a footnote to what the origin of the Highland Games. If you go far enough back in Scotland, supposedly the legend is, that this was the methodology to identify the best warriors by being able to compete in competitions of strength and speed and agility. They were able to identify the best fighters. And back in that day, it was key for each clan to have plenty of fighters in case they had issues with other clans. So they throw stones, obviously the caber toss, they lift stones, and we have so many different classes. On Saturday, we have 40-plus women. This is not unlike running, where there's different classes, and there's winner in each class. But we have 40-plus women, 50-plus women amateur, 60-plus women amateur, 40-plus men amateur, 50-plus men amateur. On Sunday, we do men's amateur again. We actually have pros. There are some competitors that make a living just doing Highland Games, and they travel to these from several. In fact, we got a young man that comes all the way from California every year just to compete. So, and these guys are, the women and men both are fantastic athletes, but some of the men are just huge guys. That's you got to imagine, if you throw a phone pole, you got to be pretty good size. And the people love it. You hear cheering.
Wait a minute, you said phone pole?
Yeah, a telephone pole. Like, they don't literally throw a phone pole, but okay. The caber is a tree.
Okay.
And it can be 40, not 40, probably 25 feet long, and it can weigh 100 pounds. 100,
and they throw these.
And they lift it. And then they throw it. And the goal is to have it spin a full time in the air and land straight ahead at 12 o'clock position. And that's a perfect throw. And it doesn't happen very often. But then depending on the class of competitor, they have smaller ones. They have right down to maybe 10 feet and very narrow. But it's, yeah, you can come see us. I've never heard about this.
Yes. It sounds fascinating. Another thing, you have parades and entertainment all day on four stages. What are some of the types of music?
Well, let me sort this out a little bit. Now we have opening ceremonies both days, and this is quite common to ethnic events. They have some. I was at the German Fest in Cheektowaga Friday, and they have their grand opening, and they tap the keg, the whole thing. Well, we do the same thing, but in our case, we're so large that we have a parade that will involve. Each day we have four pipe bands. I assume you know what pipe bands are.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And we have four large pipe bands every day, and they're part of our opening ceremonies. All the clans march in the opening ceremonies. The athletes march. We sing all the national anthems from the countries, including Canada. The pipe bands do mast bands. I don't know if you're familiar with that, where they all march together and they counter march, and it's just it's just an amazing experience. But then on top of that, and we do that both mornings because not everybody comes both days, although a lot of people do. And again, under the heading of celebrations, we have calling of the clans. So after opening, all of the clans go to our bonfire area, and we have three very large bonfires that burn all weekend. And they individually receive a torch, and then there's a bit of a description of what's going to happen, and then they put their torches into the fire that triggers the fire, and that fire will burn until Sunday night. We also do, in the evening of Saturday, we do a unique thing you'll never see anywhere else with pipe bands. They circle the bonfires. They mingle with the people in the bonfires. And I got to remember, it's four pipe bands that might be 75 or 80 musicians that get down in with the fire, and they basically jam. They're not really structured like a lot of the pipe band stuff. It's so they're all having fun, and then the people are just stunned because they're in immersion. They're sitting among the pipe bands, and everybody's phone is out, and it's just if you're into that kind of music at all, it's inspiring. And then Sunday afternoon, we do a memorial service again with the pipe bands, with the American Legion, with the clans, and we honor anybody that's been a participant of our festival in years past that has passed since our last festival. And that's just the pageantry stuff. And I probably missed something because we do. We have a haggis eating contest, like the chicken wing contest this past weekend, and the hot dog contest. We have a haggis eating contest. If you know what haggis is, you probably heard of it.
I've heard of it, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yes, well, that's. I won't, unless we have time, we can go back to the haggis. Okay. Now, you mentioned the five stages. We have four music stages and one dance stage. The dance stage will have dancers all weekend. Young Irish dancers, young Scottish dancers, adult Irish dancers, adult Scottish dancers. We've got a real unique dance crew that comes out of Rochester, more of a mature adult thing. And then we have a very large stage near our bonfires. We have another stage and a grove of trees to the back. And we have almost every Irish or Scottish band in Western New York, Rochester and Buffalo, all play at our festival. And then we bring national and international acts in as well. So this year we'll have Sire from South Carolina. We will have the Bastard Bearded Irishman from Pittsburgh, and we'll have the Glengarry Boys from Eastern Ontario, the highlights of the music.
Wow. Boy, there's a lot to talk about here.
You can't see it all. That's the thing.
Yeah. I want to move on to something else I heard about. The Celtic College is an interesting concept. Lectures and classes run from noon to 5 each day?
Yeah, this is a concept we stole. In fact, most of everything we do, we steal from other events. This genre of Celtic gatherings is so common in North America that somewhere in Canada, the U.S., there's 3 or 4 of these every weekend of the year. This is a very common genre. They start in the south in the wintertime and all the way to the north in the summer and then back down the fall, et cetera, as you go back south. In Ontario, there's several gatherings that have these so-called Celtic colleges, and some go on for 3 or 4 days ahead of time. We just do it for the afternoons. But we have a classroom set up where we can have 30 or 40 people focus on just a unique topic, whether it's art, language, weapon making, instrument playing. It's kind of a real intimate situation. In fact, what's unique is we have in this modern age, you know, how we all had to learn how to use Zoom because of COVID.
Sure.
I know nothing about Zoom.
No, neither did I.
We've learned so much. We have a lady from, I'm believing it's Newfoundland, but it's one of the Atlantic provinces in Canada that does a Welsh-speaking class from her home in our festival.
Amazing.
So we're pushing the tech. We got young people that figure this stuff out for us. And there's quite a number of topics, and they're free. Mm-hmm. They're included in the price.
We're getting short on time, so I'm going to have to move on. The after hours, what do they call it?
It's a Kaylee. It's after all, I had to learn that. I didn't know about it, but some of the early organizers knew about it. It's simply a party, and it tends to be in the evening. It's a common terminology, mainly Scottish, but some of the Irish use the term too. And that's where you'll see the biggest of the bands. It's on Saturday night, and it's one huge party. There can be 2,000 people in that space that evening, and it's all around the bonfires. And, of course, there's plenty of adult beverages. We're fortunate to have all Guinness products imported from the British Isles.
And what types, not to interrupt that, I just happen to think, what types of activities are available for children?
We have probably one of the best kids areas of any event anywhere. That includes county fairs and everything else. We have a team that just works on kids areas. A lot of it is mini adult stuff. But we will see 1,500 or more kids over the course of the weekend. And they're cute. They're wearing their little kilts and everything. And every year they come up with different activities, but they stay busy. We're not in the babysitting business, but at the same time, there's plenty. And it's a chance to start teaching the kids the Celtic cultures.
What are some of the other events that you might want to explain to listeners? Haggis
is it dates back. It's not unlike the Native Americans used to have pemmican where they had transportable food, particularly the fighters when they traveled. And the version that's known as haggis essentially is the innards of any animal. And then it's mixed with it's oatmeal or some kind of a meal. And then it's dry. And when they're out hiking or whatever, add a little water in a fairly short period of time, they had food to eat. And it's people either like it or they don't. And the other thing I want to mention on that pathway is our food. We have what we call Taste of Celtic. And my wife and I travel to Celtic events all over the eastern United States. And last year I was at 6 of them in Ontario. There's 14, by the way, in Ontario, right across the border. And we have the best damn selection of Celtic food anywhere. We have a huge selection of Irish food, huge selection of Scottish food. And of course, as I said, we also have all the Guinness products, which, by the way, Guinness is a sponsor. So we have, and mead, we have, it's just, and most people come and stay at least for 2 meals. There's such a variety. So.
Well, I hate to end this, but excuse me, you've been doing this for how long?
We started this in 2000. We started doing homework on it a couple years before, but it's fair to say we're damn near 25 years at this. And I didn't think I'd still be alive.
You still sound so excited about it. And I mean, just the way you're smiling and talking about it.
Well, I hope that you or somebody you know takes advantage of those tickets. And then you can do an update for your audience after you go there and see all this, what appears to be strange. But when you see thousands of people taking it all in, you realize it's a lot more common than you think.
Well, I'd like to thank you for being here, Phil. We've been talking to Phil Banks, founder and treasurer of the Niagara Celtic Heritage Society Board. And it sounds like an absolutely spectacular event taking place at the Niagara County Fairgrounds.
Yes, niagaraceltic.com. Everything you need to know, niagaraceltic with a C, .com.
Okay. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank Dr. Jeffrey Smalden and Phil Banks for being with us tonight on Northtown News. Anyone that would like to be a sponsor, excuse me, on WBR Radio, should contact Jackie Rance at 716-553-4679. If you'd like to join me on the air, contact me at APAP, that's APAPP, 1971@yahoo.com to set up an interview. So I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight here on Northtown News, and I look forward to being with you again next Thursday evening at 6 p.m. Hope you'll join me then, and we will have more guests. Thank you, good night, and have a wonderful week.